Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a joy to welcome back broadcaster, podcaster, wordmeister, and tip-top Britpop drum blaster, Matt Everett.
That's good.
Yeah, sorry.
I'll have that. How are you?
I'm fine. Lovely to see you again.
It's really nice to be back. I really enjoyed the last recording and listening to the ones with other people from that point, so it's very nice to be asked back. Thank you for asking me back.
Thank you for coming. The album that we're going to be talking about today, I seem to remember you mentioned in the last one, holiday trips with your parents with the red and blue cassettes.
That's right. Yeah, like a lot of people, the story starts with Red and Blue. Mm. I mean, we have really bitten off quite a large thing to chew by tackling one of these records, because they're all full of the most amazing songs. So when I was a little kid, these were my first experiences of the Beatles, like a lot of people. Mm. So we used to go on holiday, and these are on double cassette, and there's really sort of unwieldy double cassette boxes. And they'd go in the car. Everybody would be allowed to have one record, one disc at a time. So my dad would put some classical stuff on, my mum would put on, like, one of these records. And I'd often choose Red and Blue as well. So it's kind of, it's where it starts for me.
Yeah.
And they're kind of fascinating, aren't they? Because this has been talked about on previous episodes, that so many people, as these were their entry into the Beatles, they have shaped how they then went on to listen to the Beatles, because there's some, like Revolver isn't particularly well represented in the album that we're covering in the Blue album, and George isn't very well represented. And so it meant that when we then got into the band, it kind of, all these other doors opened. There's a whole theory, isn't it, that the reason that everyone used to think that Sgt. Pepper was the greatest record was it was before everybody started to discover, like, Revolver being so unusual and Abbey Road being such a sort of epic thing, because the kind of linear nature and the not simplistic, but the easy big hitters are all on these two records.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think obviously Alan Partridge has ruined the concept of compilation albums, his best of Beatles. I think this is part of their canon, surely.
Yeah.
In terms of modern-day Beatles fans.
You know? I think so, yeah. I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I didn't know the story of why they came about. Now, you will correct me here, because you know more about this than I do, was these compilation albums, these illegal compilation albums in America called Alpha and Omega, which were put out, often just taking recordings dubbed off other records.
Yeah.
And they were like a box set of Beatles songs, in alphabetical order, which is fucking mental. Like, what a weird way to sequence the Beatles' back catalogue. I kind of like it, oddly. And then with odd bits of sort of solo stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And from what I understand, their manager of the time, Alan Klein, spotted this, shut it down, thought, there's a big gap in the market here.
Yeah.
Let's put out our own versions. That's essentially the truth,
isn't it? That's it,
okay.
Yeah. And it's weird, because at the time, George and Ringo were basically sacking Alan Klein as well. So the last thing he did for them actually probably made them millions. And then, see you later. And John said, Paul was right. After all those albums, all those horrible messages in the newspapers. And then John, Paul was probably right.
Yeah. It's impossible to think about Alan Klein without thinking about Ron Decline in the Rottles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Love to Neil Innes, the ghost of Neil Innes, of course. They're kind of, they are fascinating, because the range of what they achieve is so huge, it's so vast. But for me, like, there's a couple of things, because I saw them when I was really young, and listened to them when I was really young. First of all, the amount of time seemed huge, sort of spanning from just what was, a few years, seemed immense. And it's kind of, I'm not going to say that the Beatles helped establish my comprehension of time, but when you see the two photos on the Red and the Blue albums, and as a sort of 7-year-old, you're like, these are the same people.
Yes.
What happened?
Yeah.
What happened to these guys? Gee, they look nothing like, in the space of my life, my 6 or 8 years, that I've been on this earth, these guys are recognisable. Look at the hair. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. What happened?
Mm.
And then you put the records on, you're like, that happened. That's what happened.
Yeah.
It got really weird.
Yeah. I remember seeing, because I think I borrowed the album off. And by the way, the album we are talking about today is the Blue Album, 1967 to 1970. But I remember borrowing it from a friend. Same thing, looking at the cover and the back. And then when I was finally old enough to go to Our Price in Watford on a bus, and I saw Abbey Road, and the only way I would have known that was the Beatles, because I recognised them from the cover of the Blue Album. I was like, wow. But they're unrecognisable, aren't
they? Yeah, yeah. But it's kind of, it was that idea of how much somebody could change in the space of a very short amount of time. A band, that wasn't a concept that I was familiar with till I saw these records. And the idea that a group of musicians were not a fixed thing.
Yeah.
And they could be totally different. And then when you start listening to the records as a kid, you're like, wow.
It's the oral equivalent of those photos.
Exactly, yeah.
Unrecognisable as the same band.
You know, I love them. I feel very, very strongly about them. There's also the theory that they're red and blue because it's Everton and Liverpool.
Yeah.
Is this true?
I think so, yeah. Oh, good. I've heard something.
I like that theory.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, but had they come from a different city, you know, it might have been the, you know, green and orange albums, maybe. It's something, no, it works, doesn't it?
It does. Sorry, I'm just going, I've got so many notes.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's so much to cover. It kind of, like, I've been listening to them, like, back to back. And it's kind of, it's blown my mind a little bit. Hopefully we can get through some of these. I mean, maybe I've got more to say about some songs than others. I certainly haven't got any great massive insight that Mike Lewison couldn't provide in much more detail.
I'd like to have a quick look at some context. So if we flash back to the Beatles. So this was released in April 73. So the beginning of 1973... John had pretty well all but disappeared from the public eye, and Yoko was promoting her solo album, Approximate Infinite Universe. Paul's latest single, Hi, 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 had been banned. So, don't know why.
Paul.
And,
Ever the Rebel.
Yeah. So, Sea Moon, the flip side, was the single. George was recording Living in the Material World, and Ringo just finished filming what was marketed as the world's first rock and roll Dracula movie, Son of Dracula with Harry Nilsson, in which Ringo plays Merlin.
I've heard of this, but have you ever seen it?
I saw it a long time ago, and I can't remember anything about it.
Probably very similar to Harry Nilsson and Ringo's experience of actually recording the thing, I would imagine. God, can you imagine the state of them in that era? Oh.
There's an interesting story about that, because apparently at the end... Ringo was so disappointed with the dialogue, he called in Graham Chapman to basically rewrite the whole script, which they were then going to dub over the dialogue. And there are rumours that they recorded an alternative soundtrack, which is described as Python-esque.
Wow.
So I'd love to hear that.
In the first of probably many name drops I'll try and avoid, but then do anyway. Since we last spoke, I spoke to Ringo, I did the interview with him around the Abbey Road re-release and his album, and he was brilliant again.
Mm.
He was fantastic. Because I saw the All Star Band in New York a few years ago, and they were so good.
Mm.
They were brilliant. It was like the best night out. Because you know, there's guy from Toto, guy from Mr. Greg Bissonette on drum, all these amazing people, and they just do like all the hits you could possibly want from Ringo. And I was like, when are you going to play in the UK,
Ringo? Yeah.
When are you going to play? And he was like, I don't know, they just, you know, tell me, the booking agent says this is where you're going. I'm like, that's not how it works. You can come here.
Yeah.
And I think maybe there's a little bit of reticence to, maybe it's the Brexit comments, I don't know, but like the Beatles are bigger than Brexit, you know. He should come and play, because he's great. And weirdly, on the Mark Lewison tip, I mentioned, because it was a few weeks after that interview that he'd done with The Guardian all about the tapes.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, have you got any comment on this? Oh, remember that? And I was going, oh, you said, which tapes? I don't know what you're talking about. Oh. I said, oh, Mark's got them. Well, tell him to drop them round. I don't remember that.
Really?
I don't remember happening at all. And you're going, but it kind of did. Yeah. Because they exist.
Yeah.
But I think maybe, yeah, maybe there's some stories that just he says that get set in stone so much that maybe the idea of something without being jolted, it was like, yeah, that did happen.
Yeah.
Ringo. But he was brilliant. He was as funny and charming as he always is. You know, but didn't, I was supposed to ask him one question I didn't get time for. Ringo's golden snare. Do you know about this?
Go on.
So being a bit of a drum fanatic myself, he got gifted by the Ludwig Company, who made all his drums, and he made them a lot of money, a solid gold snare drum. Wow. The only one of its kind that Ludwig ever made. And it kind of, it went missing at some point between him. I think he had it for a bit, then it went missing. And it's become like, it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark. There's a version of this film to be made where we try and track down Ringo's solid gold snare drum. Because
wow.
no one knows where it is. And I wanted to kind of get some insight into what happened to it. Because something like that, you're not just going to leave it on the train.
No.
You know? But yeah. But anyway, point being, crap end of the story. I didn't get time to ask him.
Okay.
So I didn't. So the mystery remains a mystery.
If anybody has any information,
yeah.
please let us know.
I want to know where it is.
So shall we move on to the album?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Disc one. And 11 of the 14 songs are from 1967. So that's very well represented, isn't it? Really? We start with track one, Strawberry Fields Forever.
I mean, where do we start? Let's start, actually, at the end of the song. Because some of these notes, some of these things that I'll probably be talking about do relate to hearing the Beatles as a young child. Mm. And the ending of Strawberry Fields, that strange coda that comes in, blew my fucking tiny mind. I had no idea what was happening at that point. Still really don't. And especially if you listen to the first record, the earlier one first, and then you go into that one, you kind of get into this, these are songs, it's a song, there's a gap, And then for some reason, there's a song, admittedly a stranger song, and there's a little gap, and then this weird bit of experimental shuffly noise comes in again. Mm. As a child, I was like, music's not supposed to do that.
No.
I don't understand why that's there. And it was, if we're talking about opening your horizons, it was a moment going, music just really doesn't have to be 3.5 minutes.
Mm.
It can be 40 seconds, and it can have no chorus, and it can have no verse, no lyrics, unless you count Lennon intoning Cranberry Sauce. And to this day, whenever I hear it, a little bit of me is like, that's just really odd. I've heard weirder music since and strange music. But there's something about willfully doing something as strange as that at the end of a song. And there's, I can't even remember who talked about it. The idea of, because they were so popular and successful, everything they did was beamed directly into the lives of the people of Great Britain and the wider world. And so, you know, people would be doing their ironing with a cup of tea and, like, the telly on and Steptoe and Son or whatever, and then this music would be coming out of the radio, which is mind-blowing, quite how different it was to everything else that was going on. And so that is, you know, it really does stagger you quite how out of step it was with the ordinary mundanities of life. It still is a little bit. When it came on, I used to think, what do my parents think about this? Because we'd often listen to the album together.
Mm.
And in the same way that certain lyrics would make me think, oh, should I be listening to this? That bit would be like, can my parents tell this bit strange as well? It's like, it almost, listening to it felt like being part of a strange little club for a second. It's like, yeah, you're in on this. Here we go.
Mm.
It's, yeah, do you have a similar...
Particularly on the Red album, the songs, which I think you mentioned before, the intros and the outros of their songs were so well structured. And this is just chaos.
Yeah. Because they're always very good at writing endings, the Beatles. Very good at writing songs, but very good at writing intros and outros. Yeah. The end of very good at writing. I hate it when bands just do fade outs. Really lazy, in most cases. But this felt like a distinct judgment call to do something very, 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 very odd.
Mm.
And also, you know, when you hear George Martin talking about, well, splice the two songs together, and you can hear the join. I still can't.
Oh, really?
I still. I mean, I know there's a difference, but it's like the way that George sort of describes this slightly fortunate moment when they were able to sync the two versions of the songs together. I just think it sounds flawless. I think it sounds exactly how it should sound. Yeah. So, yeah.
And lyrically, it's equally as psychedelic as the music. They just so compatible, aren't they? It's not just like any old words thrown on this psychedelic music. It's perfection.
Yeah, it's. I mean, people do talk about it being the greatest single of all time, and it's pretty close, you know. But there was, there's that tangible thing. I remember listening to it with my folks and thinking, are they all right with this music? Because this doesn't feel like when, you know, normally what would be happening around my 8-year-old household.
No.
Even then in the 80s.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece, isn't it?
It is. The Mellotron as well has a big impact on it.
And Ringo's playing on it. Yes. It's just absolutely... Yeah. I mean, Ringo is... I mean, I'm going to have to be probably stopped from talking about him too much. No, I'm going to keep talking about it. It is, you know, it's exemplary. Mm. The fills are incredible. Giles's remix of the record. Really, you know, the drums really pop on that. Yeah. It's still a work of genius.
Yeah, 55 hours of studio time spent on this. I spent half that on Please Please Me. Amazing. Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. Track 2, Penny Lane, which was a double A-side with the previous track.
It was. If I say that I prefer Double Back Alley, that sounds that sounds a little bit the sort of Ruttles version. It is a brilliant song. Penny Lane is clearly another work of Master. I don't dig it quite as much as I dig Strawberry Fields. What I like about it is it's Paul sounding like a mix of Paul and John. Paul doesn't sound like ordinary Paul. Nothing wrong with ordinary Paul. Ordinary Paul's amazing. But it's kind of him being a very... it's like a mix of both their voices. It's a different character to it. It sounds like it's been beamed in from somewhere else, that vocal take. And I love the fish and finger pie line. I think that's like... that is one of those moments when... After many, many years of listening to it, someone just goes, you know, that's alluding to fumblings, sexual fumblings, and going, right, saucy fuckers.
Yeah.
And because I was actually trying just then, weirdly, as you were setting up, to look at the history of the fish finger to see how prevalent it was in that era. And it was quite popular. It wasn't like a niche dish.
Right. Okay.
You know. So it's not like they were making the reference and everybody was getting it.
No.
I think it safely got under the radar.
Yes.
Without too much... have they admitted to that one or not?
Oh, lots of times.
Oh, good, good, fine, good. Yeah.
But I doubt the sort of... At the time the BBC presented, I reckon maybe Kenny Everett would have probably picked up on it.
I would imagine, yeah.
But not many of the others, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful... Is it tableau, they call it? Is that what the French call it? It's a beautiful scene setter. And once again, being a kid, it missed... I mean, when I opened this by saying I didn't like it, of course I like it, it's amazing. It missteps you every so often.
Mm.
You know, every so often, Macca sort of pulls the rug from under your feet a little bit with the lyrics. It's all quite jolly. Then occasionally she feels like she's in a play. She is.
Oh,
you're like, oh, little moment of like, oh...
Yeah.
It's not, everything is not what it seems. Mm. That's the power of the song, I think.
That's one of the things I remember about the Free as a Bird video.
Oh, yeah.
When you see her, and she's the only one that looks at you.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Because she knows she's in a play.
Yeah.
Really, it sends shivers down my spine, that. It just pans across. She knows.
She's aware of it, yeah. She's aware of her being in the song. I mean, it's I've never been to Penny Lane. She's awful. Because I feel like she makes some kind of pilgrimage to the place. What's it like?
It's very long.
Right.
We went this summer, last summer, on the Magical Mystery Bus tour.
Right.
Yeah, it's a long, long road with a junction. And you wouldn't know.
He doesn't mention the junction.
No.
You know, is there a longer version of the song where he talks about, you know, laundrette, yeah. There's a garage,
yeah.
There's, you know.
I think the barber, there's a barber there. Hopefully I've got this right. This barber is basically advertising itself as, well, hey, this is the barber. It's not. There's another one, another building that was the barber's, apparently.
And has that gone?
I think so. I can't remember.
So there's not
it's
two
a long road.
So there's not two warring barbers. There's not like an ongoing feud. That's a good idea for a play, isn't it? You know, I'm the original Saggy P barber. No, I'm the original Saggy P barber. Wow. Yeah, I kind of feel as if I want to go there. I can see the gates of Strawberry Fields in my mind very, very clearly.
Yeah.
But I've never actually been to Penny Lane.
I think of the two songs, I think Paul lyrically has achieved more because John is going into a dream world.
Yeah.
But Paul's is so evocative because when you're driving along, you can't kind of get the words. No. You can't relate them to Penny Lane.
It's not really very mysterious. No. Sort of going in a big diesel bus.
Yeah.
Through Liverpool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, for me, it's the video, the promo film with them riding the horses wearing the military jackets. It was later used, but...
But that was filmed in London.
Yeah, yeah, but that's what I think of.
Yeah.
Which is just, even that comes back to that sort of twisting thing slightly, isn't it? Like, just the idea of these four guys on horses going through this sort of very suburban setting, that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's that everything is perfectly normal, but ever so slightly not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Beatles on horses for a fucking start.
The original lyrics of In My Life, 2 years earlier. Again, this is John on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Where Penny Lane is one I'm missing, up Church Road to the clock tower. In the circle of the Abbey, I have seen some happy hours. Past the tram sheds with no trams, on the 5 bus into town. Past the Dutch and St. Columbus to the Dockers umbrella that they pulled down. Which is great, but it wouldn't have worked in My Life.
No, it wouldn't. It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, I like the fact that at the moment when they are expanding in every direction, both in terms of the sound of the music they're making, in terms of their kind of philosophical pursuits, that drug-taking pursuits have kind of pushed them in different directions and everyone's getting involved in different cultural scenes and art scenes. They're still writing about their home.
Yeah.
It's like, it's still, maybe it's when you get to be as famous as they became at that point, you needed to hang on to something that you knew was true and hadn't changed. They say that, don't they, about like very, very famous people say, like, you know, what you find is that you don't change, but the way everyone talks to you changes. The way that people relate to you changes. You're still the same person you were before you became famous. And so maybe it's that. Maybe it's not nostalgia, is it? It doesn't feel like everything was lovely back then.
Mm.
It does feel like this is important. Where we come from is important, which it was. You know, yeah, they fucked off to London. Who cares? Everyone fucks off to London. You know, and you know. It was part of them. Even when everything else was changing, they chose to write about where they came from and their childhood. That's pretty cool.
Next, we have 4 tracks from Sgt. Pepper, starting with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Saggy P. I like the reprise more than I like the intro, because it's kick-ass, isn't it? It's really, really great bit. What I love most about these suite of songs is Paul's quote about the concept of Sgt. Pepper, which has been documented. They started off to try and do it as thematically this band, and then after a while just gave up because they couldn't be bothered, And then Paul says in an interview talking about it works because we said it did.
Yeah.
And I love that. I apply that to lots of things. Sometimes the intent and the statement is enough. You don't have to necessarily follow through. You can just say, it's not pun intended on follow through. You just have to believe it and everything else will fall into line afterwards. And it does work. It does hang together as a concept record. It completely does. Yeah. Even though songs weren't written as Sgt. Pepper's, weirdly, somehow it does because they say it did. You know? And that's my overarching feeling about the record. And all this stuff from this era. In fact, there was... When they started to kind of become a little bit in vogue again, I remember reading an article about Sgt. Pepper. And says, I'm a little bit older now. Still love the Beatles. And it was all about... if you start to really pan the record left and right, you can hear these little details. And I'd never done that with a record before. I'd never gone, oh, my God, if I just put it on the left speaker, you can just hear Paul on drums.
Yeah.
You know, if you listen to that little bit, you can hear where this bell goes off. And I'd never done that. And it was like looking under the bonnet of music. Before, I was just, you know, watch Top of the Pops, and there's a band playing. Band plays a song. I assume the song, they go into a studio and they record it like, you know, they sing and they play, and that's on the tape, and out it goes into the world. This was like, no, there's hidden nuances and trickery and things that can fool you and things that can be slowed down, sped up. And I never realised that before. So aged, you know, whatever it was, 11. That fascinated me. I loved it. And Day in the Life is the prime example of that, because there's so many little tiny things there that you just get lost in, you know. And if you're a bit of a 11, 12 year old music nerd, having something, do you know how many grand pianos it was at the end? What, they kept on layering up these grand pianos? Really? Can you do that? I thought you just went and go, no, you can do these things in the studio. And that, yeah, that really, really spoke to me.
So you were 11 when you got the album, were you?
I was younger, but that's when I read the article. This article, it was a magazine called Making Music, which was like a sort of Muso's, free Muso magazine. And it broke down three or four songs from Sgt. Pepper in that kind of way of like, at 2 minutes seven, you can hear.
Oh, okay.
You know, an alarm going off. Really? Can you? Go back, put it on. You can. That I found that endlessly fascinating, which probably helps explain why I'm still such a massive nerd about those little details.
Yeah.
You know.
They're the best bits.
I think on Sgt. Pepper, the track, it always feels like Ringo plays a snare drum when he shouldn't. Do you know the bit?
Oh, okay. Where are you thinking?
I think it's Wonderful to Be Here. Because he does like it feels like he does an extra snare bit when he shouldn't.
Right.
And it always sounds like a mistake to me. I'm sure it wasn't, but, you know. I'm not having a go at Ringo. I'm just saying. It was far too deliberate to be a mistake. Would you believe in our love at first sight? Yes, I'm certain that it happened all the time. What do you see when you turn out the light? I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Oh, I'm going to try with a little help from my friends.
What do you think about With a Little Help from My Friends?
Once again, it's Ringo, so I love it. It's a great vocal. And it's all about... It's the one line for me as a kid again. What do you see when you turn out the light? I'm not certain, but I know it's mine. Which is a beautiful lyric because it makes you feel safe and embraced and warm. And I remember thinking, especially... It's all back to childhood. You know, nighttime, the light's going off. Being a bit scared at night, whatever, because nighttime is the unknown, darkness is unknown, and this is the song that goes, it's all right, what about out there? It's yours, it's okay. I love that line. That's the part of the song. It just feels, it's creating, like a lot of Ringo songs do, actually. It's putting you in a warm world where you feel loved, you know?
Yeah.
Is it one of yours?
Definitely. Never ask Jeff Lloyd about that lyric.
Why?
It's explained, and I don't want to ruin it for you.
So I should go back to that episode?
Yeah, but treasure your memory.
is he going to fuck it up for me?
Yeah.
No. But it's such a beautiful, it's so poetic.
Don't listen to that one.
Oh, I mean, I love him. He's brilliant. Jeff is awesome. Yeah. Awesome, very smart dude. But if he's having a go at that line.
No, he's not having a go. Hunter Davis explained the lyric.
All right, okay, yeah, yeah.
So we were talking about that, but I don't want to tell you, so... What you've said is right.
Good, thank you.
Absolutely.
I will stick to that. And now, you see, I'm going to fucking...
No, you won't.
No, I'm gonna, no, I won't. No, no, because that would... That's almost against the spirit of the lyric. You know?
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Beautiful.
Good thing. And he still does it live as well when he plays, and it's still brilliant. And people get up and dance, and it's just, yeah, it's a glorious moment. Mm.
It's lovely hearing them backing him as well.
Yeah, it's like... Because there was always... It's like... Ringo is the... I've got an overarching theory about the band, which we'll finish with. Mm-hmm. But one of the things is he is the person they all love. Not the most, but he's the person that brings out the very best of all of them. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to a song for him, there's nothing they wouldn't do for Ringo. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And when you hear him sing, you know they're not taking the mickey. When George, you know, says... I love Octopus's Garden. He means that. There is never... Ringo is not a joke. Ringo's songs have never been a joke to the Beatles. They've always been important and valuable parts of who they are.
They're all so supportive.
Yeah, totally, you know.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah. This comes back to the overarching theme we will return to at the very end. I'm building it up now. Yeah.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Lucy in the Sky?
I mean, once again, the interesting thing here is, I mean, on Macca's fucking deathbed, he is going to admit it, isn't he? It's literally going to be that, like, he'll go... You know, family, love you, great, you know, family. I can't do the voice. Love you, you know, great, and, you know, thanks for everyone, you know. It's been great, and the music's been my great love, and Linda's been great. It's been brilliant, and it's been a really magical journey, and I'm so gracious for it. LSD was drugs. Lucy's Sky with Diamonds with drugs. And he's going to go. Because it's just bollocks, isn't it? Pretending otherwise is clearly...
They've all stuck to the story, haven't they? They've all stuck to it.
Someone decided that over a well-constructed bifter. The four of them in Abbey Road. We're never going to say it. And then they just thought, it's almost like a loyalty to that promise that they've kept to it.
If they'd done it in, if they'd done it in 63, and it was just like, I love her and she loves me, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds... But the lyrics don't really help, do they?
Yeah, their lyrics would indicate a psychedelic experience. Mm. I mean, the thing that I love about this, there's many things about this, which relates back to Penny Lane, Marmalade Skies. So it was a characteristic of John's and the Beatles writing that to use the mundane as the fantastical is much harder and much more effective than writing about goblins and dragons and fantastical stuff. If you want to really create something that's going to provoke a sense of the other and the really weird and the strange, make it about normal life that's not quite normal. Comes back to Penny Lane again, you know. And he could have, the lyrics could have been about seeing multi-headed winged serpents and, you know, cascades of lightning waterfalls with multi-headed unicorns, which is
prog rock,
psychedelic-y, I guess. That there's that part of it, the prog rock thing, but he doesn't. It's Marmalade Skies. It's a thing you have on your toast in the morning.
Very sort of quaint Liverpudlian breakfast.
Exactly. And I love marmalade. I've always loved marmalade. Big marmalade fan. Used to have a lot of marmalade sandwiches. Liked Paddington. And so I kind of felt a kinship with that line. I just think it's really, really clever to use newspaper taxis.
Yeah. It's stuff lying around his house.
Yeah.
But with a sort of lysergic twin.
With a lysergic twin, which is, you know, I mean, I would, from what I have read about that experience, yeah, it's, I don't believe you necessarily see things that aren't there, but you see the things that are there in a slightly different way. But no, it's not about that. It's about Julian.
It's a painting.
And he's painting. God almighty, bless. You know, yeah, it's also, it's a very mundane structure for a song. This is the other weird thing about it. Lennon, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, had total disregard for the convention of verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. Even from an early songwriting point, he would have pre-choruses that were shorter and, you know, whatever. He wrote to what he wanted to hear, not necessarily in a structure. But this is a very, very basic verse, chorus, half verse, chorus. Mm. That's like one of the conventions of pop songwriting.
Yeah.
And I think that's even stranger, that we're not even going to go, here's a weird bit that pops up in the middle, here's a strange little seag or a bit of weird noise coming in to make it feel weird. We're not. We're just going to play it really, really straight.
Yeah.
You know. Paul's bass playing at the end of the song is brilliant. I mean, as if it isn't brilliant in everything he does ever, because it is. But he really has a lot of fun in the last couple of few bars, you know. What a player. There's a lot of that on this record. There's a lot of it on every record, but yeah, he really does.
Well, he was overdubbing bass, wasn't he? He was listening to the song.
Absolutely nuts, the counterpoint. And so they'd record the song, then he'd go back and overdub the bass, which is a really difficult thing to do anyway.
For a drummer, it must be a nightmare.
Yeah, you know, so it means that he's playing. He gave himself a chance to really compose these astonishing bass lines. But it's very difficult to lock in with a drummer if you're recording it after the drummer's done their take, you know. But
they were so tight.
They were so tight, yeah. But it's about drugs, though. It's about drugs. Come on, guys. Still, like, one of you, just say it. Say it. Just, you know. Next song's called Big Reefer. It's all about a coral reef. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It wasn't. I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the
The last track from Pepper is A Day in the Life.
For a long time, I think this is my favourite song ever, I think, because it is just a complete world unto itself, isn't it? It's Ringo again. Ringo's drumming is absolutely insanely original at this point, and I will keep saying this forever. Anyone that says he's a shit drummer is wrong. Either they don't know how good he is, or they're choosing to be, you know, difficult.
Yeah.
To even play those drum fills that he plays, to even come up with them, even if Paul helped him, to come up with them, to deliver them like that, the way they come in, the sound of the drums, the unusual nature of that, the phrasing. It's insane. It's like they are as important to the tension and the dynamic of the song as any part of it. It's a joy. It's a joy to listen to.
The phrasing of his drums on that song remind me of On With a Little Help from My Friends. It's doing the same job as their backing vocals on that song. It's sort of singing a line and then Ringo's there for us.
It's just phenomenal. Yeah. And, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a drummer who wouldn't love to be able to
play like
that. As a
drummer, and you're a right-handed drummer.
Yeah.
Physically, how difficult is that to do?
Because it goes against the way that you'd normally think about how the drum feels supposed to go, because he plays differently. He leads with the left hand.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. I love Paul going upstairs and having a smoke. I love that. And I love it's the demo version when there's a cheer in the background, isn't there? Yeah. Yay! Yeah. Just a roll up. It's not. It's a spliff. Mama called me, grabbed my hat, made the bus the second square. Made my way upstairs and had a smoke. Everybody smoking, I went. for me, also being a kid, it felt like I really bought into, when I was little, I bought into this idea of John and Paul being the big buddies. Which they were, which the thing is, then you grow up and you think, no, they were enemies and they fought. And then you get a bit older in your life and you think, nah, of course they loved each other. They were those buddies. They were those people. And the duality of the song, it's the very best of John and the very best of Paul together in one song, which once again, thinking, wow, you could put, the song can change in the middle. Can it do that? Yes, it can. Mm. You know, aged 8 or 9 years old, I hadn't heard any music that ever did that.
Yeah.
Change pace, change tempo, change everything. And yeah, my we've got a 12-year-old in the house, and we talk about music all the time. He's a pretty musical guy, and he was like, "Drag a comb across." The other day we were talking about this. He said, "Drag a comb across your head." I was going, "Yeah." He said, "What, like comb your hair?" I was going, "Yeah, but it's not just." And he was like, "Oh, right." And he sort of got this idea of like, that's how you feel in the morning.
Yeah,
you're not, you know, you're trying to get your shit together. And an 11-year-old, you know, a 12-year-old was going, okay. He picked up on that being a really unusual word to use in that context. Mm-hmm. And it says a lot about who you are when you get up in the morning and you can't quite get it together.
That one line.
In that one line, So, yeah, that was really sweet seeing him, you know, feel a similar way about it that I did when I was that age.
Are you actively encouraging him, or is he discovering himself?
Joseph, if you listen to this, they're really good. They are really good. He likes Revolution a lot because it rocks. Mm. And we've got a lot of stuff around the house. We've got a lot of Beatles things around the house. So he's kind of it's part of the atmosphere. And he was brought up on it.
Yeah.
His mum played the Beatles.
Well, same as you, I guess.
Yeah. So, yeah, but we'll come back to the... This will tie into my theory at the end as well. But yeah, he's surrounded by it. But I love that line, drag a comb across my head. It's brilliant. The bit that gets me in it, that gets on my nerves about it, is that the lyric, a crowd of people turned away, I just had to look, having read the book. Surely, a crowd of people turned away, I had to look, having read the play.
Ah.
That, to me, John, feels like a better lyric.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not, you know, my standpoint as a songwriter is slightly less worthy. But that kind of, I don't know why that gets on my nerves. It irks me, yeah. Mm. It's a very bizarre thing to do, like literally one of the most, you know, beautiful pieces of music ever. This was it. And what a way to finish the record.
Mm.
Yeah, it was for a very long time, it was my favourite song, full stop.
I remember as a kid discovering about the I never could see any of
one
at the end. But apparently there's different... Right, if you want to get nerdy...
Oh, God, yeah, of course I do.
There are different versions of that on different pressings. Sometimes it cuts slightly before, so you can get different phrases from it. So I never could see any of the ones, or whatever it is.
So it goes longer and shorter depending on what the pressing is.
My pressing, I always thought was, I never could see Alex. I never could see Alex. And I was trying, is it Alex? You know, Magic Alex. Or I don't know. And if I, on that pressing, and I did it on my stereo, I did it backwards.
Brilliant.
And it said, blah, 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 Paul is dead. Blah, 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 Paul is dead. Blah, blah, blah. It was freaked me out. But anyway, I digress.
Anyway, yeah, we'll come on to misheard lyrics. We'll come on to Kangaroo Dave for Across the Universe later. Who is Kangaroo Dave?
Nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do but you can learn how to be you in time.
All you need is love.
Yes. I mean, there's a lot to cover here. It's a beautiful song. Here we go. This is an example of what I was talking about the way that John sometimes wrote songs. Because the time signature is all over the shop, isn't it? It's like, according to my notes, it's a main verse pattern that contains 29 beats split into 2 7-4 measures, a single bar 8-4, followed by one bar of 7-4 before repeating the pattern. Most pop music is 4-4.
Yes.
So And I love the fact that I never even noticed that until I got much older and started to, you know, listen to music in a sort of slightly more analytical way. It doesn't sound like it's a weird time signature.
No.
You know, you listen to Gordon Brown by the Stranglers, you'd be like, that's weird.
Mm.
Or certain pieces of, you know, Take Five by Dave Brubeck, you're like, well, this is an interesting time signature. All You Need Is Love does not sound like that.
No.
It just sounds like a perfectly ordinary song. But it's not. Time signature's all over the place.
Yeah.
Which is genius. The other thing I like about it is George's solo.
Oh.
Because it starts off, I mean, the very, very best of George. This beautiful... Oh, God, that's great, yeah. George. Oh, you've done it again. You've barely played a note, mate, and you are just... And then he does it again. Oh, that's, you know what? That's the only way of making it better, was just play that perfect phrase once again.
So far, so good.
You beautiful, beautiful man. This is why you were so important. It wasn't about your, maybe, you know, the incredible dexterity of your playing. You just knew exactly what to play. I wonder what he's going to do next. Oh, he's just going to stop. And then go, a little bit. It's like, what did you, why did you stop playing, George?
I wondered.
Stop playing, man. It was going so well.
It was.
I mean, is there a case for when you start a solo that well, there's no point carrying on? In my mind, and looking at the footage of that session, they are so stoned. Him and Ringo. Ringo's barely holding the sticks.
Mm.
Looking very happy.
Yeah.
And I think George, in a similar kind of like, maybe he just got the point, just thought, I don't know what we can do next. But it's brilliant. And they kept it. They printed it. That's the version you've got. That's the version that got played to 15 billion people, whatever the ridiculous number of people it was.
On our world.
All around the world. It was like, yep.
Yeah.
That's the one then.
And they didn't bother overdubbing afterwards. It was fine. That's fine.
Have they talked about this?
No. I'm wondering if they planned to overdub that afterwards. So George was sort of fumbling away and they just sort of forgot about it and used it. And I don't know. I like it.
I'm not criticising George. I'm not criticising. Yeah. But in a slightly more philosophical sort of point, that when you've spent a lot of time listening to, you know, these songs, as we were talking about, and you start to understand as a kid how deliberate music can be and how careful you can be and how you can plot these different things to happen in very specific ways, and you can alter sound and reverse things, and you can achieve, you can realise your vision in a very precise way. Here's them going, yeah, but fuck it.
Mm.
And game music doesn't have to be...
No.
Precise. Music doesn't have to be perfect. It can be imperfect. It can be imperfect. There can be something missing and something a bit wrong. And that's okay as well. That's another big step in understanding what pop music can be. It doesn't have to be deliberate. It can be deliberately wrong.
Yeah.
And that can still be perfectly right. Because that's a mistake.
Mm.
There is no way.
Oh, yeah.
There's no way that George played those two phrases and thought, and that's me finished.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't hear him going, in the background a little bit and sort of chugging away a little bit towards the end.
Somebody did a cover of that and did a full solo, it'd ruin it.
Exactly.
It?
Oh, yeah.
Well, stop.
Yeah. They did the right thing.
Yeah.
They did the right thing. George played the right notes.
Mm.
But yeah, that's kind of, I love that. That's learning about music. Music doesn't have to be perfect.
Mm. And also it highlights, who we haven't mentioned yet, George Martin.
Because
he finishes, you get the strings playing. And throughout, you know, most of this album, George Martin, especially 67, just shines, doesn't he?
What a dude. God, I must have really fucking hated Phil Spector. He really... But we'll come on to that later. You imagine how much... Anyway, talking about George's arrangement, and towards the end you get these sort of beautiful waves of different themes come in and out in songs, and there's the must say, whatever. And then Macca sings a little line of She Loves You.
Yeah.
And this is why I kind of wanted to do this record. You're not supposed to reference yourself in pop music. This is not something that you do. Blondie never went, dun, 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 we're Blondie, here we are, we're Blondie, dun, dun. We did Heart of Glass last week. Didn't happen. I'd never heard bands making references to their own work before like that. In fact, no, I can't think of many bands that have ever...
I can think of one.
Go on.
And I'm wondering if it might... Thinking about it might have been a little slight. The Monkees.
Yeah, okay.
Could that be... Hey, I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much.
That thing, mind you, that was a song all about being the Monkees.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's an Art Brut song. Remember Art Brut, indie band, the 90s? A song called, what was it called? We Joined a Band. And it's just about them joining a band. And we're going to write a song, and this is it. I love that. I think it's really interesting way of playing with what you're supposed to write about. Mm. And that was like, instantly when I heard it as a kid, I was like, I'm in on the joke. I know that one. I know that song because I heard it on the other cassette. Mm. It's them. They're playing one of their own songs. Wow. Mm. So they know.
Yeah.
They know about their past. They're happy to put that into one of their own compositions. And it feels like a reward. But it's like you're looking directly at the listener going, it's us.
Yeah. And it was after Pepper as well. So they knew people were digging for clues.
Yeah.
And then a little Yesterday as well was in there.
Is there? I didn't hear that
just
bit.
After that.
Yeah. Is there?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I didn't know that. You see, I'm learning something. This is what I was going to hope. I'm by no means the expert. So I need you to pass this information on to me so I can become even more nerdy.
Or even more people like I do.
It's a lovely thing. Self-referencing. It's one more door as open to you as a kid in music. You can do that, can you? Yeah.
Flipping over to side two, I Am the Walrus.
Yeah, this is. I mean, they're all great, aren't they? They're all brilliant. I used to get very, very freaked out by the line about knickers, as we've talked about extensively, and will continue to do so. This was the album of my childhood. Sorry, and so we'd be listening to it with the family, often on holidays. And that line, John would say that line, and I'd sort of furtively look round. Oh, have they noticed that as well? That's really, really saucy. I don't even quite know what it means, but I know it's not the sort of thing I normally hear in a song. And feeling very self-conscious about that. Mm. And obviously, you know, the kind of imagery that you get in your head when you listen to lyrics. And as a kid, it was quite a powerful, powerful, very evocative line. And it used to make me feel slightly unusual, should we say.
Well, as a word, it's a very...
Knickers?
It's not... You know, Americana, most of the, up to 66, most bands were, you know, following American lyrics and singing in American accents. You don't hear the word knickers in like any Elvis songs or...
Blue Suede Knickers.
Or Bob Dylan or...
Yeah, no, wouldn't. How many knickers must a man... Yeah, Subterranean Homesick Knickers. Oh, come on, there's got to be some more of these.
Oh.
Yeah.
Lay, lady, lay, no.
No,
lay
no.
Across my big brass knickers. I don't
know. Big brass knickers. But you're right, you see, I've just been wanging on about like the kind of slightly quasi-sexual nature that you've just... But when you just say the word knickers, it's M&S, it's knickers, it's you've got your knickers on, everything's all right, go to work, put knickers on, off we go. It's a safe word. Knickers. Oh, just go and have you washed my knickers? Yep, they're in there, they're with socks. But yes, it's a peculiarly English word. Do you think the Americans, like, I guess they knew what he was talking about.
I don't know.
Does he mean panties?
Yeah. Is that the America? I don't
know. I guess so. I'm not American, and I don't wear knickers. Well, I wear pants, but...
I've never discussed knickers with an American.
No, which is the title of your autobiography,
yeah, it is,
I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
let us know.
And you can tweet.
Yes,
I am Nick Cod.
Do tweet us. It's another masterpiece. It's John being just. Well, it's gobbledygook, isn't it? It's just. He says it's all rubbish. It was just, you know, nonsense. Mm. I'd like to read more into the Walrus thing and the whole Lewis Carroll, you know, Walrus the Carpenter bit. I'd like to think that he was making some kind of comment. But I don't think he was. I think he was probably just writing a load of gobbledygook.
I think so. There's a few. It's more the kind of picking out the random phrases. I mean, Eggman. I was reading an Eric Burden book. Can't remember the name of it.
Beast of Burden.
No.
Should have been.
Should have been, shouldn't it? Basically describing a girl that Eric Burden used to see who had a particular fetish with eggs.
Right.
Don't worry about it. And apparently there was some party or something where John bounded in and Eric was with this girl and they were doing this thing with the eggs. And John said, "Hey, go on, Egg Man." So that could possibly be where the phrase came from.
Were they cooked eggs?
No.
Presumably not raw. Mm. Well, I mean, from a health and safety point of view, salmonella, I'm sure the egg... When did the egg marketing board start? Because, I mean, these days, obviously, eggs are relatively salmonella-free, but in the late 60s, were there sufficient rules and practices in place to ensure that most eggs were... You shouldn't eat raw eggs anyway. I mean, do you make...
I don't know. Right, I'm going to... You can read it here.
Okay.
We might not use
it. Oh! What? That's not hygienic. That is actually not hygienic. She did that. Mm. What? Ooh. Oh, dear. Oh, amyl nitrate as well. That's not a good smell, I would imagine, mixed with omelette, raw omelette. What kind of parties were these?
But back to the song. And again, wow. George Martin shines.
Yeah. It's there's the lovely bit, isn't there, on the anthologies when Paul is defending Magical Mystery Tour. And, you know, one of his main reasons is for, it's the only recorded performance of I'm the Walrus.
Yeah.
And it is astonishingly cool. Just like properly daft, and genuinely surreal, and who doesn't look good with a inside-out half football on their head? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a great look.
Yeah,
it's difficult with some of this stuff because they're so ingrained, aren't they? But it's genuinely still. If you stop, this is what I've been doing. We were saying, so you go back and listen to these songs again after having known them since the age of 7. It's still weird. They're still strange. They still have the capacity to shock. And we know I do a lot of stuff on a radio station. And sometimes the way we talk about a new song that comes to the station, whether we're going to play it, is like, if it's from an established band, it's like, well, if this was a brand new band, would we play it? Okay, so this is the new song from, you know, whoever, Elbow, Charlatans, whoever it is. Is it a good song because it's them? Or are we also going, if this song arrived on our desks as a little tiny MP3 in a box, would we still play it if we didn't know who this band was? And I think with something like I'm the Walrus, if a band released that right now and we didn't know anything about them, we'd think they were fucking geniuses. Mm. You know, that's the power of some of those songs. Not all of them, but definitely that one. You say yes, I say no. You say stop, and I say
Hello, Goodbye.
Once again, not a huge fave of mine, really. Going back again, gosh, it's all about my childhood, isn't it? I remember sitting in an English garden, sitting in a caravan that belonged to a mate of mine when I was at primary school, so I would have been about 10, 9 or 10. and playing this and him going, it's about them. It's about John and it's about Paul. It's about the pair of them. They're kind of having an argument in the song. I remember thinking, once again, all right, can you do that? Can you write about the very thing that you're experiencing with that person and then you and that person put it in a song? Yeah. I remember thinking that was once again, it was like I was part of a little secret club. Mm. You know, oh, I'm there now. I'm there, I understand. It's a little window into these two people that I think are so great. Their friendship. This is a bit of their friendship. Of course, the reality was probably absolutely nothing like that whatsoever, was it?
I think with all of these lyrics, it is what you remember it as, especially during your formative years. I think, you know, there's so many little lines that you just treasure for years and you never quite know why. I think doing this, what surprises me most is that, you know, pre-internet, you know, there's millions of Beatles fans all around the world sitting in their bedroom listening to Beatles records. And doing this now, everybody has got kind of the same memories that I have.
Really?
And there'll be no way, you know, all the stories match and little bits that they remember and particular lines that meant to different people. I thought, yeah, that was the same with me. And for years, you know, I guess pre-internet, there was no way for people to share their thoughts and feelings on this. So that's why I love doing this, because I'm like, I felt like that, yeah.
We're all joined together. Yeah, it's like the, like when Bowie died and we were on the radio show, I think we were the first people to broadcast the news.
Oh.
To confirm, it was a really, really strange morning. And I'd love Bowie hugely, enormously, massive fan of Bowie. And I'd always thought that, you know, I liked him because other people liked him, I knew, because he was really famous and successful, but I liked him because he spoke to the kind of slightly weirder, uncomfortable, strange bit of my, you know, teenage soul. Mm-hmm. And it was me, that's why I got Bowie. The rest of you just like the tunes. And it was everybody. Yeah. Everybody felt the same way. Everybody has a little bit of the alien in them. Everybody has a bit of the outsider, the strange, the uncomfortable, the weird person that wants to reinvent themselves. And everyone has that. But because you feel like that, you don't necessarily think when you're younger that everyone does. Mm. And so when Bowie died, everyone was like, we all loved him for, you know, different reasons. But one of the main ones was that feeling of he speaks to us as the odd one. Mm. We perceive ourselves as being the odd one and everybody else normal. So yeah, I get it. I totally get what you mean about it. Hello, goodbye. It's not a fave. You know, I like a grass skirt and a hula and a coconut bra as much as anyone, but I don't really, it doesn't come up on my radar that much. What's it about?
Paul was challenged to write a song. And so he said, say a word, hello, goodbye. Literally wrote it like that.
I mean,
the friend.
Hats off, Paul.
So,
for being able to do that. But yeah, there's, it's, I don't know. There was that devastating comment that Lennon made about yesterday. He was talking about it in one of his phases when he was hating everybody. He said, you know, but nothing happens. Mm. And you're like, oh God, what an awful thing to say about a song. But I don't feel quite that vituperative towards it, but I do feel a bit it's a nice enough song, but it doesn't really.
Well, it ends 67, doesn't it? And you think all that they've done in 67, it's you're gonna compare it, aren't you?
Yeah, this is true. This is true.
Again, would that be if you got an MP3 through with that? Would you play it, do you think?
I don't know.
Really?
I don't know. It's got some good playing on it. I mean, they're playing great. They do really play great at this point. Also, I mean, this is the other thing about this record, is the kind of sequencing of the album is, which I think, I don't know how much the band had to do with it.
Alan Klein did it. The whole thing.
The whole thing. God, that's why George got fucked, didn't it? Mm. But you need, in a record, you can't just have songs that generate a similar kind of impact next to each other, because even if they're brilliant songs, it just doesn't work as a record. So for me, it's kind of like I need a bit of the next three songs to get me through this next phase.
Yeah,
I need, you know, I don't really need massive bangers. I just need to take a bit of a breath while the next few songs come along, which is good because the one after it, the one we're about to talk about, I don't like it at all.
Fool on the Hill.
Yeah, Fool on the Pill. Don't like it. I mean, this is... Now, you see, obviously, I love Paul McCartney dearly. He can do no wrong, actually can do no wrong. And so any criticism I'm citing, he's literally, it's ridiculous that I should even be criticising a song that Paul McCartney has written, because he's a genius. But I've got a problem with recorders.
Oh.
I've got a big problem with recorders because, childhood again, the first musical instrument I was ever given to play, like lots of kids, was a recorder. Fucking plastic, dark brown and cream recorder. And we were forced to sit on a mat in the school, in the lesson hall, was it called? Where your classroom is.
Classroom.
Lesson hall? Lesson hall.
Those rooms.
Yeah, those rooms that teachers teach lessons in, yeah.
Rooms.
Where the classes go.
Yeah.
Classrooms. And so this would be my second year in school, so I would have been like 5, 6? Very early memory. And sitting there with a bunch of other kids, all being given fucking recorders, and making the worst noise. Not only is it the worst noise of any instrument, I was shit. I was so bad. I couldn't put things on the notes properly, no matter how much. And I loved, even as a kid, I'd love music. I knew this music we're talking about. Anything I was doing did not sound like anything I'd ever heard coming out of the big wooden studded stereo in the lounge. And I resented it. I resented the instrument for not being a guitar, for not sounding like anything that I wanted to hear. Mm-hmm. I couldn't play it. And they had this, well, it's like a tier system. So you had, I don't know, 20 kids, something like that, 30 kids in the class. And the closer to the front you were sat in the rows of five or whatever, was the better you were at the recorder.
Oh.
Right? I presume for the teacher's own fucking sanity to be furthest away from the kids that squeed, weed, wah.
Yeah.
And so I think I started like second row or something because I'd been quite enthusiastic about the idea of a recorder. It was a musical instrument. This is a good thing. But then gradually, as the weeks went by, I was moved further and further back on the rug. So I was literally like back against the wall, weaseling away. And it's, if you get the, no gag intended, if you get your fingering wrong on a recorder, it's instantly recognisable. That squealing, high-pitched noise. There are few things in life worse than the assembled cacophony of school kids playing the recorder.
I
hate it.
Did it impact Paperback Writer? Because I'm guessing you would have been playing Frère Jacques.
We did. London Bridge is Falling Down.
Oh, yeah.
All the fucking all the hits. Just it's all, and whenever I hear a recorder, I'm just there again, and I'm like that with Stairway to Heaven. I know Stairway to Heaven may not be the greatest Zepp song, but it's certainly part of the canon. And you know, you, when you first get into Zepp, you kind of love it. The recorder in that. That's it. Hackles
Game
are up.
Game over.
Game over. And same as this. I really do object to that noise. Did they get five-year-olds to play it?
It's Paul.
Oh, it's Paul. I mean, like, I love you, Paul, so much. But you could have chosen a flute, or like you had enough instruments at your disposal, i.e. all the instruments in the world. You are like one of the most musical men that's ever lived. You have an ear for a melody that is... I'm not saying... What they're playing, note-wise, is something I don't appreciate, or it's not got its own melodic merits, but it's that fucking sound. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do. Oh, Jesus, make it stop, please. And I think as a lyric, it just feels a little bit like Nowhere Man. It's similar. We're in a similar thematic world to Nowhere Man, which feels... It's got a bit more depth to it, you know. I think what Paul said, it's about, you know, people being being interpreted as being wise when they're not, or vice versa, or being ignored when they are wise. And I never really got that. It just feels like it's a bit of a dickhead on that mountain, on that small mountain.
Yeah.
Dickhead on a Mountain. Alternative title.
Was that the Smiths?
It was. Dickhead on a Mountain. Oh, no. I don't really like it. But that doesn't mean I'm right in that opinion. I will hasten to add, because it's Paul, isn't it?
Magical Mystery Tour.
Yes, love this.
Drumming.
It's just, it's properly Ringo kicking. He's swinging.
He is
swinging on this track. And I like the fact it hasn't really got structure. It doesn't really. It doesn't. I mean, I said that like songs not going anywhere can be a bad thing. In this case, it's just, it's exactly what it is. It's a title sequence, isn't it? And coming back to this idea of like, if we say it works, it works. We're off on a magical mystery tour. Here we go. This is it. This is the title sequence. This is all you need to know. Where are we going? Doesn't matter. What kind of tour is it? Who's going? Doesn't matter. We're just going there. We're going today. Going now. Right. There you go. That's it. It's all you need to know. The voices are beautiful. Really, really fantastic voices. And yet there's that... The more you get into the later career, the more you really start to relish when they're playing together. Not like White Album Together, which is like... You know, there's a whole thing about the looseness of some of those sessions. But when they're there, when they're on it and playing together, like the outro of Saggy P, you know, when they're just kicking a little bit.
Yeah.
And they've got that. The horns are great. It's, you know, it's Paul's very much Paul thing, isn't it?
Mm.
It is a title sequence.
Yeah.
And then it just sort of ends. In this lovely little sort of coda, I guess you'd call it, whatever. Once again, it's... Can you just stop the song? So there hasn't really been a verse. It's really all chorus, sort of.
Yeah.
The lyrics don't really say anything apart from the fact that, as I've said, we're going later today. That's it.
Yeah.
And the simplicity of it, I think, is really great.
And it's one of the last times from sort of Beatlemania period we get the three-part harmonies... of John, Paul and George.
Yeah.
They come up sporadically after this time, but it's all three of them singing together, especially on that final... On a magical mystery.
It's a great, really, really great little bit of belting from Paul there, isn't it? He really screeches that in bit. They sound so good when they sang together. It just sounded, there's whatever it was about the timbre of those voices, the way they... You know, whether that's luck or whether they just ended up singing that way because they were singing next to each other and they... I don't know. Whatever it was a thing of utter beauty.
Finally, move into 1968 with their first single, Lady Madonna.
Yeah. Now, I always had a problem with this song. I thought it was a little bit of a, I don't know, a bit jolly and not inconsequential, but I didn't really have a great connection to it. And then I got married earlier this, late last year, in December.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And we had a band at the wedding. I was in the band. Got some mates to play, and we were trying to work out what songs we were going to do. Only wanted to do a few, because if you do more than four or five songs at your own wedding,
can be a bit awkward.
It becomes a gig,
yeah,
and it's a bit ego strokey. Not that I mind a bit of ego strokey, but it does feel a bit like you've just kind of invited everyone to witness you fanning about on the drums. So like only four songs, and my now wife, said, "Oh, Let's do Lady Madonna, because her dad's a musician and he can play the piano on it."
Oh, brilliant.
And it's a good sort of barnstorming, you know, rollicking pub piano piece. And my dad will do it. I was like, brilliant, fantastic. So we'll do it. And the more we rehearsed the song and the more I played it, the more I got to really, really love it.
Mm.
The more I got inside the song, the more I realised what an impeccable piece of songwriting it is, because it's so concise. It's in and out. How long is it? Let's have a look. Lady Madonna. 2:18
Whoa.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
It feels longer, doesn't it?
Because
there's so much happening in the song. That's good songwriting. It's got a kazoo solo, which my wife did at the
brilliant.
At the wedding.
Superb.
She played a kazoo, which was brilliant. And I feel about kazoos the opposite of how I feel about recorders. Kazoos are brilliant. Anyone can play a kazoo and get a tune out of it because you just go do 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 do, and you've got it. So the sound of amassed kazoos is a wonderful thing, and they, you know, they have an amazing sax solo on that song. It's all over the place. Yeah. It's a really jazzy thing. It's great. And yeah, the structure, like that Leonard thing, the structure in the last verse, chorus, end bit is really unusual. It's not a conventional structure and catches you out unless you kind of really think about how it goes. But it doesn't sound like that. It just sounds incredibly simple, which is great songwriting. So yeah, I love that song now. I've got very, very, very good memories of hopefully not murdering it too badly at my wedding.
Oh.
This is when I need you to say, oh, actually, Lady Madonna was a close school friend of Paul's mum. No, we don't have any.
No. Although, Kate Robbins, I asked her about this. Or I asked her about songs that referenced people and that she might recognise. She suggested it might be about her mum.
Okay.
Who, you know, a lot of kids and not that much money. So, and I think she said that Paul alluded... Yeah, kind of, maybe.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I mean,
it'd be lovely to think, you know, sing about his family.
Yeah,
that early in the.
He'd do that, wouldn't he? He'd do that. And yeah, whoever she is, I always liked her. Mm. I always, as a kid, used to think she was, you know, oh, this is a pretty cool.
Yeah,
it's a pretty cool mum. She's got some stuff going on. She's got her problems, but she's powering through it.
Mm.
Good on you. I like that. You know.
Thanks. Also, something I picked up, which I've only just thought about, when we interviewed Neil Innes, and he was talking about when Paul came in to produce Urban Spaceman.
I listened to the episode. Good episode. Good work.
Oh,
I know.
But what happens on Urban Spaceman is what happens on here, because Neil was saying originally on Urban Spaceman it was boom-tch, 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 boom-tch. And then Paul came in and said, OK, keep that, and then overdub it with a boom-tch, boom-tch. Which is exactly what he does on Lady Madonna.
Oh,
so I'm wondering if you think, well, yeah, that's only good. Yeah, that'll work with Urban Spaceman. Same principle.
He's a clever fucker, isn't he?
Drum and bass he's inventing in
1968. I mean, he is, yeah. As I say, I'm a big fan of drum and bass. I like the drums and I like the bass. Yeah, what a dude. And he does it live these days really well. It's a right rollicking performance. Abe L'Oreal, that's not how you pronounce his surname, is it?
Mm.
Abe, Paul McCartney's live drummer for a fair few years, is a fucking spectacular drummer.
Yeah.
And when he gets loose on this one, there's a really good live version of a reasonably recent live album where he's like, he's Ringoing, but he's also kind of Abing as well.
Yeah.
And he just knocks seven bells out of it. It's a great, great version. So, yeah, brilliant song.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart, then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin,
next, Hey Jude.
Oh,
over to you.
Well, the best thing about Hey Jude... No, it's not the best thing. It's the thing that instantly springs to mind if you've got to talk about it. And many people, like all of these songs, and, you know, often on this podcast, people have spoken about these songs with more expertise and clarity and wit than I am. But I love the moment when John falls off the stool. That's the best thing. Ever.
Right.
So, when I was talking earlier, many years ago on this episode, because we've been talking for ages, about an article that I read when I was in my early teens, 15 or something, about the Beatles in the studio and, like, literally taking apart tracks like that. Mm. And 15 seconds in, you can hear this. 20 seconds, you hear this. It mentioned, it was about Sgt. Pepper, but it mentioned offhand the moment in Hey Jude when so-and-so-and-so-and-so John Lennon falls off his stool and says, fucking hell. Mm. And I was like, that, what the, what? What? No. I've been listening to this song for years. Go back and listen to it, and there it is.
Oh!
Fucking hell. And it blew my mind in the most wonderful way because, A, they kept it in.
Yeah.
They kept it in. And they knew exactly what they were doing when they did that. And it got played everywhere.
Yeah.
It still gets played everywhere. To this day, you know, around the corner at Radio 2, next to where I work at Six Music, they will play that song. And no one doesn't edit. No one's lifted it out. John Lennon saying, fucking hell, is on the radio to this day, and certainly was at the time.
Yeah.
That's fucking genius.
I know.
He just got away with it. Under your skin. And it's not like it's incredibly quiet. You can hear it. If you know the, oh, at the start, which you'll probably drop in at some point, then you're ready to hear it. Oh, here it comes. There it is. Oh. And I love the fact they didn't stop the take.
No, no. They did a lot of takes of this as well.
Yeah.
But they kept that particular one.
You know, I love the fact that given the really emotive kind of beauty behind the lyrics and the intent of the song, they didn't think it was weird to put in, not a gag, but certainly like a moment of real, like, hey!
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Fish and finger pie.
Fish and finger pie.
To the next level.
To the next level. And that kind of, and that wouldn't have happened had they not all agreed. If John would have gone, lads, I sound like a bit of a twat there. I don't want me falling off the sword to be on the record. It would have been lost. If Paul would have gone, this is my song, you know, look, it's quite a serious thing, I don't want it in there. It would have gone. But they all looked at each other in the studio during the playback or even just straight after the performance or even during the performance and just thought, yeah, I'll keep that. Yeah.
And George Martin as well.
Oh.
He would have known.
Boys, boys.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah, it's going in. It's staying in. And I mean, there's very little I could say about this song that people haven't said before. It's glorious. It's glorious because it's them really playing again. Ringo's ride cymbal sound is obscenely bad, but somehow sounds brilliant in the song. It's like he's hitting an old copper kettle. Mm-hmm. Dang, 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 dang.
Yeah.
But somehow it sits within everything and just provides the right frequency or whatever, the right tone to work. The backing vocals are lovely. The tambourine works very good.
Mm.
Very good tambourine work. We haven't talked enough about tambourines.
No.
Very good tambourine band. It comes in the right. Who did Mal do a lot of tambourine with them? Or was
They would have overdubbed them.
So yeah,
Paul was particularly good on the tambourine. I seem to remember. Really.
Have you? Is there like there's good? Someone will have done a document, an Excel spreadsheet of who played tambourine on what, aren't they?
Yeah,
it's probably you, isn't it?
Don't start me. I get told off for doing this. So I can't go any further.
But yeah, it's really, really lovely, lovely tambourine. There's a whole tambourine thing. Maybe I should do a tambourine podcast. The distinctive nature of different bands and their tambourines is a fascinating to me, but probably no one else, sphere. Because like you listen to Radiohead, they have a very specific tambourine sound.
Okay.
And they use very small tambourines a lot of the time. And it's like their sound that no one else uses. The Stones have got a very distinctive tambourine sound. And it's just a very, gets overlooked a lot. A, the playing of tambourines. I'm boring myself now, by the way. And the sound of tambourines. And whatever the Beatles, I don't know what tambourine they used, how many bells it had got on it, which I think is the technical term for the little things that look like old milk bottle lids.
Yeah.
Whatever it was, it's perfect for the song.
Mm.
And it comes in at exactly the right moment and does exactly the right job. Mm. Fucking genius. Say you want a revolution. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? And we end with Revolution, the B-side of Hey Jude. By this point in the album, we are. It's becoming noticeable that some songs are not included. You come to realise, why is Blackbird not on here? You do start to think, if we're entering this sort of era of revolution, we're about to get to a point where, like, we really should be, you know, George should start getting some love by the end of side two here, really. And it does feel like a little bit we're being given a very specific view of the band. But Revolution is a fucking great song. And I don't like all the other versions. I know they had to do them, and I had to do them. And for some people, those might be the versions. I love the disdain in Lennon's voice when asked about it being a single. He said it was too slow. Mm. I love that. It's a fucking belter. Ringo's drumming is phenomenal. I don't even know how he gets the drums to sound like that. Mm. The guitar sound, it sounds like they just plugged it into the desk and just not like not sort of put effects on it through an amp or crunch the amp up or whatever. It's like they've plugged it directly into the recording desk and turned everything up till it breaks and makes this phenomenal noise. It's like even when it's not loud, it sounds really, really loud. Mm. It's a belter. Mm. One of my favourites. Because you have that thing, I don't know if you get that, where you sometimes be musing on, or perhaps, I wonder what it would have been like had they all stayed together, not had they all lived to this point in time. Because like these days, I think in terms of a live performance, they could deliver properly. In the 70s, PAs weren't as fucking good. Monitors, equipment, you know, microphones, you couldn't have done them properly on a stage. And even in the 90s, I think there was, you know, things weren't as sophisticated as they are now. Mm. And, you know, imagining what they would have sounded like had they gone to headline Glastonbury or whatever. And loads of songs wouldn't have worked. And you imagine, yeah, you know what, had they tried to do Day in the Life as Glastonbury headliners, would it have worked? Would it have been a bit, you know, messy? But you think, they could have played the hell out of this, couldn't they? In their 60s, maybe even their 70s, headlining Glastonbury for the 50th anniversary, the Beatles would have done a really, really good version of Revolution.
There's that tantalising story at the end of 68. They were planning on doing a gig at the Roundhouse.
Yeah.
It never happened, and they would have... Because Pop John at the time was doing this on Rock and Roll Circus, so they would have played this 100%.
Yeah. Oh. That's the thing. It's like, you know, I'd like to have thought, this is just completely daydreaming, isn't it? Thought that if it ever would have happened, they would have treated it like they treated everything, which is like, we can't just do what people expect us to do or the same old thing. They would have gone out as a heavy little rock and roll band, which is what they were, you know. In the same way as Paul doesn't tour with the whole horn section. He doesn't tour with the horn section. He doesn't tour with strings. He could. He could tour with extra keyboard players to fill out sound and make. He doesn't. He's just got his band, his little band. That's how he goes and plays out because he likes that thing. I mean, Wix's keyboard player is phenomenal. Does it. Like he's awesome man, nice chap. But he likes the band. And I like to think that if they would have gone out and done something, if they hadn't, very inconveniently, 50% of them died. I think they would have done it as like a little rock and roll band. I think they would have been fucking awesome. And Revolution should have been the opening number on that Glastonbury performance this year that never, ever is going to happen, sadly.
Matt Everett, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
As predicted, we're going to have to get together for part two.
Is that all right? Can I keep going?
If you don't mind.
I would love to. I've got my big unifying theory. Well, not unify. I've got my theory about them, which all this, having listened to all these songs so much, specifically this album over the past couple of weeks, I've got a theory that's to do with this album, my childhood, and four Fisher-Price Beatles figures. Have you seen these? Oh my God, you're going to lose your mind. Wow. Little, you know Fisher-Price? Yeah. Right, okay. We're coming back to this. We're coming back to this because you're going to love this.
What a cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Matt Everett, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.